Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
That's why people elect leaders, and that is to not maintain the status quo, but to change it.
A young African-American leader brings change to the cradle of the Confederacy and the Civil Rights Movement. I speak with Montgomery, Alabama's first black mayor, Stephen Reed. And Citizen K, a new documentary, tracks Mikhail Khodorkovsky's journey from Russia's richest man to Putin's greatest nemesis. I speak to him and to the Oscar-winning director, Alex Gibney. Then
we actually were out there to bring terror to people.
A true believer breaks away from her hate-spewing church and family. Michelle Martin speaks with author Megan Phelps Roper about leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Montgomery, Alabama is a city of great contradictions. The former capital of the Confederate States of America is also the birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement, home to Rosa Parks, and host to some of Martin Luther King Jr.'s most stirring rhetoric and acts of civil disobedience. And come Tuesday, Montgomery will once again bear witness as the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. The city celebrates the inauguration of Stephen Reed, its first African-American mayor. The majority black city is plagued by crime and economic inequality in a state ranked dead last for education. And as he prepares to take office, I asked Mayor-elect Reed about his daunting to-do list and the history he is making. Mayor-elect Stephen Reed, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I am really good. I want to know how you feel, because here you are making history in Montgomery, which, as everybody knows or should know, is the cradle of the Civil Rights Movement, but also of the Confederacy. How will you feel as a person taking the oath of office when you get inaugurated there?
I feel really great about the accomplishment of what we've done in this community and how far we've come. The race has never been about me as much as it has been about the collective hopes and dreams of the people in this city. And that is a belief in a more positive future and a future that is filled with opportunity. Certainly it comes with a great deal of responsibility, given the history that we have here. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. leading the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks kind of jump-starting that. We've had a very complex history here with race. But we've come a long way, and we're a city that really wants to focus on the future as opposed to our past.
You know, obviously those are the facts, but it's also something that is inspiring a lot of people, not just in Montgomery, which is 60% black, after all, and you are the first black mayor to be elected, but people around the country who's looking to see what's possible in these United States in these highly divisive times. And I know you mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King. Of course, he paraphrased the great words about history and the moral arc bending towards justice. In the context of the history and all the other things you just mentioned, do you believe that your city, your state, the country is actually moving towards justice? Or is this, you know, a nice anomaly?
I think the country and our state and city are certainly moving towards justice. I think there's a long way to go. I think we have to be more open and more candid about how we get there. But we've made, obviously, positive steps across the country, and Montgomery has been a part of that. We're having honest discussions about what we can do differently and what we can do from a policy standpoint to really bring about more opportunity and more equity throughout not just our community, but throughout our state. And as long as we keep willing to have those conversations and we make sure that we act on them, then I think we can continue to move forward. And so while it's great to have mayors in Birmingham and Selma, Montgomery, and other places that are African-American. It's also important for us to remember that economically, we still face a lot of challenges. African-American households still face a significant wealth gap. There's still a gap tremendously as it relates to healthcare access. And so what I hope that this election will do is it will allow people to understand that we want national and international partnerships with people, with organizations, and with companies who really care about not only the civil rights history, but also the future of civil rights in this country. There are still issues regarding race and reconciliation that we have to deal with, not only in Montgomery, Alabama, but throughout this country. And we have to be very honest about that. A lot of the language, a lot of the actions, a lot of the policies do have a disproportionate impact racially on people of color. So we have to be very truthful about that, but we also have to be willing to do some innovative things to change those outcomes. And what I hope the election will represent is the ability to have a new narrative for the city of Montgomery, for us to start a new chapter.
So I just want to read a list, and I'm going to read it because it just shows exactly what you've got to deal with and what's on your plate as mayor. You have said that you'd like to tackle failing public schools, high crime, police community relations, inadequate public transportation, unhealthy water supply in some areas, brown water, we understand, not to mention food deserts and the poverty in many parts of your city. I mean, that's a very ambitious and very necessary list of policies that you want to tackle. What do you think is most important to start with? What sort of keeps you up at night about what you need to do?
I think the thing that we have to start with is education, because I see that as the root cause of a lot of other issues that we're dealing with. And I believe that if we're really to be intentional and deliberate about what we have to do to transform our public education system, to make sure that everyone, regardless of their neighborhood or zip code, has an equal chance at opportunity, then we can achieve some of the other accomplishments and objectives that we really have out there. Now, listen, I certainly know that the list you just read is a long and challenging list. I'm aware of that, and it's not something I expect to happen overnight. But it is something I expect us to make progress in. It is something that I expect for us to impact in a more positive manner. That's why people elect leaders, and that is to not maintain the status quo, but to change it. And one of the things that I ran on was I didn't want to be the thermometer anymore and take the temperature of the city, but I wanted to be the thermostat so I could set the temperature of the city. And that means being very ambitious. That means being very deliberate and being very honest about what our issues are and how we go about changing some of those issues. And that only happens by acknowledging that we have a problem and then working to solve it.
Mayor-elect, how would you grade or rate your ability to work across party lines? Your father, obviously, for decades, has chaired the Alabama Democratic Conference. You grew up in a political household. People remember you, apparently, from seeing you as a young boy in church. And a lot of people are obviously incredibly proud of your accomplishments. But you do have a Republican legislature. You have a Republican governor. And you may eventually get another Republican senator. We'll talk about this in a second with Jeff Sessions wanting to recontest that seat there. But what can you as a Democratic mayor do in this environment?
Well, the old saying is, all politics is local. And so we want to make sure that we're working with all of our stakeholders and all of our elected officials, both state and federal, as well as obviously our local city council, to really address the issues and not look at them from a partisan perspective. We want to look at them from a citizen perspective of what's going to be best for the citizens of Montgomery and what's going to be best for the citizens of Alabama. And I believe if we take some of the partisanship out of some of our discussions, we can meet in the middle and we can find that common ground. That's what we did in the campaign. That's how we were able to win with almost 2/3 of the vote. We were able to reach across lines to really bring people into a shared perspective that we have for our future. And I think that if we can continue to do that, then we'll be able to work with our state legislative leaders, our governor, as well as our congressional delegation. And I look forward to doing that. I've already had some initial discussions with them, and I believe that we're going to be able to accomplish some great things together.
People look at the United States right now and the federal government and see a whole load of gridlock because of partisanship, and it spreads around the country as well. And to an extent, it's happening in places around the world because of this highly, some would call it very toxic, partisan nature of what's happening. But there is a lot of interest in mayors, not just in the United States, but also around the world. Books are being written on actually what mayors can accomplish for their own cities, even if the wider context is more difficult to penetrate. Again, just speak to me about what you think the power of the mayor's office is.
I think the power of the mayor's office is only limited by the person that occupies that office. I think that we have the opportunity as mayors across this country to really transform the landscape locally, because we understand that we're competing in a global marketplace, but we also understand that we can impact things on a local level. And we can often move things a lot faster locally than maybe you can at the state or national level. And so that's one of the things that attracted me to the opportunity to serve as mayor, was how could I move the ball forward and how could I improve opportunity for everyone who lives here in a very impactful way. And so in the end, the election is certainly historic, but the true legacy of my term will be, what do we do over these next 4 years? What type of relationships and partnerships can I create to stimulate investment in this city, in this region, and in our state? And I think there are a number of mayors across this country that are already doing that. And I plan to blueprint some of the ideas where they work, and we'll implement some of our own new ideas where they haven't.
And now to your own state and to trying to sort of, we've talked a little bit about, you know, healing the divide or working across party lines and across ethnic and color lines. We know that Alabama is a very red state, and that in the last election, unusually, there was the first Democratic senator to win Doug Jones because of all the issues with Roy Moore. But now we know that the former Attorney General Jeff Sessions is saying that he wants to contest that seat. What do you think? Some people are saying that Doug Jones may end up only being a one-term Democratic senator there. What do you think when you see yet another Republican senator maybe taking over that seat again?
I see that as being something that the voters of Alabama will have to decide what type of leadership that they're looking for. Certainly, Senator Sessions served in this capacity for a number of years and was reelected. He has a track record here that I think appeals to a large segment of Alabamians. And so on the Republican primary side, they have a lot of choices to kind of filter out themselves. I think from my standpoint as a mayor, I have to work with whoever is in Washington. And I plan to keep my agenda the same regardless of who occupies the U.S. Senate seat that currently exists right now, whether that's Senator Jones or whether that be former Senator Sessions or someone else. Our agenda is going to remain the same, whether that's increasing federal funding for public transportation, whether that's utilizing more innovative practices in our affordable housing programs, or whether or not that's just really helping build our infrastructure.
This isn't the first time you've made history. I mean, as a probate judge, I think it was that in 2015, you issued the state's first same-sex marriage license. And then the chief judge there at the time, Roy Moore, who we've just been talking about, refused to enforce it. He was then, you know, censured for it. But there are a lot of hot-button issues, aren't there? Do you expect yourself to face some of those? I realize you're in a different capacity now. Or how those hot-button issues may, you know, may still be points of friction between communities?
You know, I think hot-button issues are something that comes with the territory. When you're a leader, you're in that position to make decisions that you feel are in the best interest of the people that you represent. I don't believe you can lead with the ear to the ground and the finger to the wind. So I make decisions based on the positions that I have morally. I make decisions that based on positions that I think are right for the people that I'm serving. And that has been a great kind of benchmark for me in my career so far. And we'll continue to do that. But where there are controversial issues, what I try to look for, again, is the common ground in that. And that doesn't mean we always have to agree. That doesn't mean we always have to be 100% on everything that we're saying. It just means as long as you understand my position and my perspective, then maybe you'll respect that a little bit. Maybe you can appreciate it even if you do not agree. And to the degree some of those things may be controversial, so be it. If it's for the betterment of Montgomery, if it's going to increase our ability to compete, to recruit and retain great talent, to build a community of opportunity for everyone here, I'm willing to take that task on. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day, is really leading to make a difference. If I may say something, just the other day, we commemorated the 30th anniversary of the Civil Rights Memorial here in Montgomery, Alabama. And one of the things that I talked about there was ordinary people who made the ultimate sacrifice to do extraordinary things. They didn't do that because they were trying to be on the side of what was politically expedient. They did that because they were doing things that they felt was a just cause. And that's what we have to get back to, I believe, in our politics, and not really worry about the poll numbers and not really worry about the cynics or the critics, but understanding what it is that we are put in position to do and why we need to get those things done.
Well, that's obviously very rousing, and it will be very inspiring for many people. Mayor-elect Stephen Reed, thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Montgomery, Alabama is also home of the National Memorial to Peace and Justice, a commemoration of America's history of racial violence. And as that city struggles to move beyond its strained past, we turn to Russia, which is also reckoning with the legacy of the Cold War. November 9th, this Saturday, marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And today, the notion that that event marked the end of history is clearly just a pipe dream. Few people personify that tangled evolution like Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Once a leading practitioner of Russia's brand of gangster capitalism, Khodorkovsky now lives in exile here in Britain, trying to support the opposition in Russia against President Putin. He spent nearly a decade in Putin's jails on a series of politically motivated charges. And his story is the focus of a probing new documentary by the Oscar award-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney. I spoke with them and both of them, and with Khodorkovsky via a translator, and asked about his wild, quintessentially Russian story. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, you're sitting here with me, so I want to ask you first. There was a big ovation when this was first shown, and people really seemed to like it. Why do you think people are sympathetic to the story of someone who was an oligarch, who you could call the epitome of gangster capitalism in the post-Soviet Union Russia. And yet, your story now is resonating with people. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, people presumably understand that capitalism in Russia can only be wild because we didn't have the kind of experience that you had in the West. If we were to have had all of a sudden good capitalism, that would imply that people would behave differently. But in fact, as Alex manages to show, Russia changed in the process, and we changed in the process too. And I think these kinds of changes resonated with the public in general.
Alex, you've heard Mikhail describe what he thinks his story is. What do you think his story is? What about him attracted you to wanting to make him the central figure of Citizen K?
Well, I've done a lot of films about power and abuses of power. And after the 2016 election, it seemed to me important for Americans and the rest of the world to understand a bit more about Russia, and particularly how power worked in Russia. And it seemed to me that Mikhail's story was emblematic or a great way of looking at power, because he had been at the very top of this kind of Wild West or gangster capitalism. And then by challenging Putin and trying to suggest that there was a better way, he was sent to prison. And then he was at the absolute bottom, where his only power was to be able to kill himself. He went on a number of hunger strikes in order to be able to enforce some minor changes having to do with how some of his people were being treated. And then ultimately he's let out by Putin after 10 years in prison. And now he works in exile from London to try to bring further changes to Russia. So that journey seemed to be very dynamic and powerful to me in terms of trying to understand how Russia works.
So you've set up the trajectory really well. So I want to go back now to how this all sort of unfolded, Mikhail, because here you were doing really well. You first had a bank, and then through, you know, the ability to grab a massive amount of the state oil, you had Yukos, one of the biggest oil companies in the world. And then you started to confront, even in public, on television, President Putin on issues of corruption. And that essentially quickly led to your being arrested. I want to play a clip from 2003, which is the news footage of them coming to get you and what your lawyer said.
То, что я увидел, позволяет совершенно очевидно на 100% утверждать, что это абсолютно политическое дело.
Khodorkovsky est accusé de fraude et d'évasion fiscale.
So to stay out of prison, why didn't you leave the country?
Не настолько дорожу своей жизнью, чтобы обменять ее на потерю уважения.
So, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, that is a very brave and profound statement, that you refused to exchange your dignity and your self-respect just to save your life. I mean, as Alex said, you could have, but you didn't. You stayed to face the music. But begin by telling us how you survived prison, because it was brutal.
Well, in fact, prison, for anyone used to Soviet youth pioneer camps, or the Soviet army for that matter, doesn't actually differ that much. You understand more or less how things are structured. I have to admit, though, that I did enjoy one real advantage. I was roughly twice as old as the average prisoner. The average age of most prisoners was 23, and I was 40. And that in prison obviously affords you some respect, education as well, of course. But in brutal Russian prisons, you can see that the basic foundation of everything is violence, and many people under the influence of violence snap and do things that they would never have done in ordinary life.
And you did gain not just respect, but I guess security also, by, as Alex said, going on hunger strikes to demand conditions for yourself, but also for other members of, I think, Yukos, who are also imprisoned, and some other prisoners who are not perhaps getting some of the same treatment you were getting.
Well, you know, in prison, you can really only get things if you put your life on the line. And you have to understand that once you've done that once, you will never be able to obtain anything else. And it was precisely for this reason that I had to think very carefully about putting my life on the line for other prisoners. But I did that four times. And four times, I was prepared to die unless my conditions were met. And I was successful all four times. And here, of course, outside support played an enormous part. Many people, in fact, many Russians who went to court and made demands on the government, and we managed to convince them. If that hadn't happened, things would have turned out far worse for me.
Alex, how did you view the arc of his development as a character during your storytelling? And I guess I just read something that you've said about, you know, when you look at these, you know, larger-than-life characters who you tell stories about, empathy is one of the key qualities. You say you have to empathize with people, otherwise you inhabit a view of the world that I don't believe in, which is that there are good people and bad people, whereas I believe we are all a mixture of both. How does this Citizen K fit into that structure that you've constructed?
Well, the simple structure is rise, fall, rise. But in terms of the quote that you just mentioned, I mean, you know, Mikhail in the wild and tumble 90s in Russia inhabited the ethos of the time, which was be as ruthless as possible in order to get as much money as possible. As he himself admitted to me, he said he thought of it as a game, Well, soon he realized it wasn't a game, you know, particularly when the ruble fell and oil prices fell and he was having to lay off tens of thousands of people. But it really wasn't a game when suddenly he landed in prison. And I think all of us face moments in our lives when we have to make a decision about ourselves. And when we're faced with a moment in crisis, we can either, lapse into self-pity, talk to ourselves about how sorry, you know, everybody should be for us, or we find some kind of inner strength to change. And I believe in the idea of change. And one of the most powerful things that Mikhail said was that he said he found in prison that life wasn't about having, it was about being. Well, that's a pretty profound statement, you know, particularly from somebody who had come from where he had come from. And I know a lot of billionaires. And when they see this tiniest bit of adversity, they tend to retreat into self-pity. Mikhail didn't do that. He came out the other side to try to see life in a completely different way. And so as a filmmaker, you know, that was a powerful story to follow.
I want to ask you also, Alex, about the challenge of including things that he may or may not have liked. They sort of sentenced you and convicted you and charged you in absentia with the murder of a mayor in a Siberian town. And Khodorkovsky has said in other interviews that including that murder charge in your documentary is a sign of how well, Alex, Putin's propaganda machine has worked. You obviously disagree, and you say no. What do you say? Because I think that's one of the rare instances where you might disagree, because it's generally a positive look at Khodorkovsky.
Well, I think the parts of there are bits and pieces in the 90s where it's not quite so flattering. Particularly, there are archival clips of Mikhail, you know, talking about how greed, effectively, the Gordon Gekko, greed is good. But I think in terms of the murder for me was a very interesting phenomenon and important to deal with, both because it showed the rough and tumble period in which everybody was living. But also because I think it's a narrative that changes over time. And that, to me, was the interesting thing about how, Putin's regime dealt with that murder. It became a murder that was malleable. You change the facts as time progresses, as you need to. And so the perps at the beginning changed in the middle and then changed again at the end, so that while they went after initially as a culprit, you know, one of the Yuko security people, by the end they were charging Mikhail with having masterminded the crime, which I don't in fact believe. But something clearly happened, and nobody really knows what happened. But the key thing is the propaganda mastery of how it was handled in Russia. So much so that when I go to Neftyugansk, which is where the murder took place in Siberia, everybody we interviewed to a person said, oh, absolutely, we know who did the murder. It was Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Well, that was genius on the part of Putin. I don't think it represented the truth, but I think it, in the film, it shows how propaganda works.
So you're listening to that. He doesn't think you did it or ordered it, but any clarity on who might have done it? Could it have been a UCOS official who wanted to please the boss, you? I mean, any more clarity on that murder?
Well, obviously not. But at the same time, I have to give credit to how well the propaganda machine worked. So this gave me and the opposition a very difficult task, in that we have to work with this machine and realize that they were capable of this kind of thing.
Well, talking about Putin, you've essentially had a 20-year battle with him. It's interesting, though, that when he first came to power during the Yeltsin years, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, you said the following about him. You were talking about initial misconceptions about Putin and what you initially thought about him. This is from the movie.
Мне казалось, что он идеологически наш человек. Человек типа нашего поколения, который, в принципе, все понимает и хочет Россию двигать в том же направлении, в котором ее хотим двигать мы, то есть к открытости, к демократии. Как же я ошибался?
Сейчас это скотчем.
Он очень талантливый КГБшник, очень талантливый.
You're now out and in opposition to him. You're here in London, where many other dissidents have been, you know, threatened killed and otherwise come to harm. How powerful is Putin? The narrative today is that Putin is outfoxing the Americans, the West, and everybody, that he is making Russia great again.
He is influential and at the same time not influential, because he's built around himself a myth that he is somebody who is in complete control of Russia. That, of course, is not true. In fact, Russia cannot be governed from one point only. So what you have today is a kind of social contract. But whereas in the past that was with the people, now it is with his feudal elite. And he allows them, thereby, to do what they want, and they, in return, ensure him of votes. Internationally, of course, it's a completely different narrative. If you look at Trump, for example, the president of a country with an economy 10 times more important than that of Russia, you can't compare them, because somebody like Trump can make use of, say, 1% or 2% of the GDP without Congress. Whereas Putin, with the approval of the Duma, the Russian parliament, which is entirely under his control, could make use of 30%, or let's say 15% of the country's GDP. So this is very interesting in comparative terms. For Trump, the death of 10 US citizens as a result of his decisions will be a problem. Whereas for Putin, the deaths of 10,000 would be a problem. So there you have a comparison of their respective strengths. But here we come up against a problem, and I fear that it's a global one, in the West, which is lack of leadership. You just can't see the kind of leadership which is essential for any democratic system. So against this background of insufficient leadership, Putin, of course, looks very efficient. But then put him on the same level as, say, Margaret Thatcher or de Gaulle or Reagan, and he looks very different.
Interesting. So that's for Putin and his relative power or not. And you have, Alex, really focused on people and situations of power. You've done now this and through this, you know, focused on Putin as well. You've done also a little bit on Trump. You did a documentary that involved his business, and you're about to do another one. Tell us what about power fascinates you and what we might find out with your work on Trump.
Well, power fascinates me because it's how we move the world. It's how we get things done. But what I'm also fascinated by is how people abuse that power. And, you know, it seems to me it's the job of a documentarian or the job of a journalist to confront those abuses and to point them out. And in so doing, you know, I tend to spend a lot of time, more time on the perps than the victims, because it seems to me if you want to stop crime, you look at how criminals do their work. When it comes to Trump, and, you know, and I think there are some parallels with Putin in terms of how they present the truth, how Trump, at least, is trying to eviscerate things like a free press and an independent judiciary, though I don't think he's succeeding. But I think in terms of what I'm doing going forward is that, you know, we're still in the United States confused about what happened in 2016. So, you know, later on next year, I'm going to release a film about what I think really happened and what that might portend for the elections in 2020.
Can you give us a little glimpse of what you think really happened?
Well, I think that the idea that there was a kind of simple conspiracy theory that Trump was a creature of Putin, afraid of the compromise that he had on him, is completely wrong. I do think there was a Russian attack on U.S. systems and an attempt to sow chaos. But the attempt was partially successful because the candidate who was running was a master at sowing chaos. That's his genius, is just to grab attention onto himself willy-nilly without any real plan. His campaign wasn't really a campaign. Nobody knew how to reach him because there was only one or two people you could talk to. So I think that the larger message about what happened in 2016 may be that we met the enemy and it was us.
That is fascinating. Alex Gibney, always great work. Thank you very much indeed. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Citizen K, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Christian.
Well, in order to better understand Russia's actions today, we have to go back in time to the fall of the Soviet Union. As we mentioned earlier, nearly 30 years ago, the world watched as the Berlin Wall came crashing down, and with it, the Iron Curtain of communism. Tomorrow, we mark that historic anniversary with three people who witnessed it firsthand. Here's a sneak peek.
Well, the very first thing I felt was surprise. I'd been at some sort of a reception in Bonn. I went home. My wife had her face right against the television screen, and she said, the wall has opened. And I said, how many cases of whiskey have you drunk? And then I telephoned the British general in Berlin, who was my sort of representative there, and it was true. And so my second reaction was joy, because obviously it was going to open a better era in Europe.
When we heard that the wall was going down, we decided to take part in the physical demolition of this structure. So we went to the Brandenburg Gates and we made our very modest contribution to the physical destruction of the wall. And for us, it was a great happening. We were very young. We thought that it was almost like a miracle or a holiday. And of course, everybody was very enthusiastic. And as a Soviet citizen, I can tell you that I didn't feel any unease or awkwardness because Gorbachev was a magic word for many Germans around.
For me, the most important thing about it was the ordinary East Germans who felt liberated, having been stuck behind the wall for nearly three decades. And I remember one of them said to me, I just saw a poster which had said, only today is the Second World War over.
Thrilling times and more tomorrow. But now, the Westboro Baptist Church is one of America's most notorious religious hate groups. It gained worldwide condemnation for its pickets at military funerals and celebrations of death and tragedy, even the September 11th attacks. Megan Phelps Roper is the granddaughter of its founder, and she was one of its staunchest supporters. But 7 years ago, she broke with the church, and she now works to combat extremism. Megan sat down with our Michelle Martin to talk about why she left. And a warning, the interview does refer to that hate speech, which might offend some viewers.
Megan Phelps Roper, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to tell you that I have the same reaction to meeting you in person that I think a lot of people had to connecting with you online, which is that you're a person who, along with your family, I don't know what else to say, except that for a lot of people, you're a terrorist. I mean, you're a terrorist, except that you didn't kill people. Mm. Your whole reason for being was to terrorize people, to make them feel terrible about themselves, to cause them great pain at their most vulnerable moments in their lives. How often do you think about that now?
Frequently. I mean, it comes up in conversations. I'm constantly meeting people that I hurt. You know, this is not... When I go and talk about these things, this is not a theoretical, it's not a theoretical apology. It's something that I live every day.
What exactly was the church protesting?
And well, they would say sin, all kinds of sin. It started out being particularly about the LGBTQ community and then expanded from there to other Christians and Jewish people. Anybody who said anything against our message was a target.
How did it get to soldiers' funerals, though?
So it was after, you know, once, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan started, and, you know, my grandfather was, you know, watching, he watched the news constantly, and he would see these funerals, and he would say, you know, these aren't funerals, these are patriotic pep rallies, you know, people out there waving flags and talking about how God is blessing America. And so he, you know, it was our duty, he said, to go and bring this godly message, God's side of it, which is, as Graham's encapsulated it, they turn the country over to fags, they're coming home in body bags. Mm. That's how he encapsulated it. And so, but that was the idea. You know, this country has institutionalized sin, and therefore God is punishing them, and we need to go to where they're saying God is blessing America and say, no, God is cursing America. And this dead soldier is evidence of that.
I just need a minute to kind of deal with my own feelings from having seen your family picketing at military hospitals, the famous signs, thank God for IEDs, thank God for your dead soldiers. I mean, I saw you out there with these young people whose bodies were broken, people who had lost limbs serving their country, and you're out there screaming at them. And I just, it's just hard. It's just, it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely understand. The, you know, when people, you mentioned people seeing us as terrorists. And we were. You're right. We absolutely were out there to bring terror to people. We believed that the purpose of that fear, was biblical, right? So there's this passage that we would quote from the book of Jude. It says, of some have compassion, others save with fear. So our goal in those moments, it wasn't just to cause pain needlessly. We thought that it was the only way, the only hope for people to experience this pain in this life, which is minimal compared to the pain that people would be experiencing in hell for eternity.
One of the things that so surprised me about your book is to understand that even as you were doing this, you were living in the same world that the rest of us are living in. I mean, I think that a lot of people have the image of Westboro Baptist Church as people living in a compound.
No. Nope.
Your kids went all to public schools. You went to the same schools as everybody else.
We went to college. Many went to law school.
Most went to law school. I also learned from the book that your grandfather insisted that all of his children and their spouses go to law school.
Right.
So how did they maintain this immersion in this worldview?
You know, the vast majority of people in the church are people who grew up in it, right? So they were indoctrinated, just like I was. And the idea is that it's like being inoculated against outside ideas. We were constantly exposed to those outside ideas. We would talk to people on the picket line or, you know, reading books and listening to music, you know, popular music. It wasn't like we were, you know, like you said, that we were not corralled in any way, like physically. It's just that before we were ever exposed to those ideas, before we were ever exposed to outside arguments, we were taught, here are the arguments people are going to make. Here is why they're wrong. Here is the Bible verse, the chapter and verse. Memorize it.
Were you happy?
Absolutely. I loved everything that we did. I believed
that it was... You loved screaming at people and seeing the distress on their faces and the horror. You liked it?
You know, my mom, when we first started protesting soldiers' funerals, I said, I need to know exactly why we're doing this. We're going to be out there. I need to understand why. And she started quoting these Bible verses. That was always the source of everything that we did. It was, you know, God saying, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse, a blessing if you obey me and a curse if you won't. And she said, can we all agree that a dead child is a curse from God and not a blessing?
I'm not sure if people do, but people particularly who live in Kansas may remember your grandfather. Fred Phelps, the founder of the church, was a very highly respected civil rights lawyer. I mean, people may remember Topeka, Kansas is a Brown v. Board of Ed. It is the home jurisdiction of one of the most famous civil rights cases in the history of this country. Yeah. But it was certainly not the only civil rights battle that had to be fought. And your grandfather was taking these cases, defending African-Americans who, in some cases, couldn't get other lawyers, white or black, to take their cases. What happened that he then became obsessed with gay people, with LGBT people, with picketing soldiers? What happened?
So my grandfather saw no tension between those two positions that he took. He saw them both as being scripturally derived. So he would say, God never said it was an abomination to be black or female or old, but God did say that it was an abomination to be gay.
But why this particular obsession with, and I think it is fair to call it an obsession with homosexuality?
Yes. So, you know, anytime people would ask that question, we would say, we're obsessed with it because you're obsessed with it. That's literally how we would respond. Because, you know, remember, this was the early 90s. You know, this was when the battle for rights for same-sex, you know, people, the people in the LGBT community, that this battle was kind of coming to the fore, right? You think about how quickly things have changed in the past 30 years. And my grandfather saw that changing tide as an abominable thing, something that God was going to punish. not just was going to punish, but was punishing this nation for. And so because it was this, you know, this constant, you know, Ellen came out and, you know, there's all these cultural moments. And he thought we as Bible preachers needed to go and be out there representing God's side of the matter.
And tell me about the tactics, though, the disgusting things that you would yell at people. Why is it that these tactics you saw or your church saw as biblically appropriate and not the other messages that say, speak to people with love, love being your driving virtue, the greatest of these is love, and so forth. Tell me
right.
about that.
So, I mean, it goes back to Westboro's understanding of what it means to love, right? So love thy neighbor, the first time that appears in the Bible, is Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18. And it says, thou shalt not hate thy neighbor in thine heart, but thou shalt in any wise, I'm sorry, thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart, but thou shalt in any wise rebuke him and not suffer his sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So for us, that was a very clear indication that, so it says you shouldn't hate your neighbor, but you should rebuke him when you see him sinning, right? The idea is, and the comparison the church would always make is, if you see somebody like wandering out into traffic, you have a duty to say, hey, stop that, you're going to get hurt. And it was a similar idea. Like if somebody is committing sinful acts, then God is going to curse them in this life and then send them to hell in the next.
One of your signs was God hates your feelings.
Yeah.
What about within the family? Was that the environment in the house? Don't have feelings?
God hates your feelings applies specifically to any thought or feeling you have that goes against how Westboro understands the Bible. And so, yes, absolutely. Any indication that you did not like what was being required of you was going to be met with severe punishment.
And you mean physical punishment.
I do mean
you
physical
mean being
punishment.
You mean being...
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier, like, how is it that this has taken such hold of their minds? How does that become so deeply ingrained into you? And part of it is, because as a child, it is physically beaten into you. And that is not something that, you know, it's something that my family has long denied. It was far worse for my mom's generation than it was even for me. And even you know, for my siblings and me, I would use the word abuse, although it's still hard to use that word, to acknowledge it. But that's, you know, eventually fear of God replaces fear of pain. Fear of hell replaces fear of that physical pain.
When did it start to change for you?
I got on Twitter in 2009. And, you know, the first, you know, at that point, we were very heavily focused on the Jewish community. And so, you know, I, with my cousin, you know, she sends me this list of the 100 most influential Jews on Twitter. And number two on that list was a man named David Abitbol, who ran a blog called Jewlicious. And, you know, so he was one of the first people that I targeted. And
by targeted, you mean?
I mean, I was just sending, it wasn't a threat or anything. It was, you know, tweets, well, I shouldn't say, it was a, you know, threatening hell. But, you know, just basically saying Jews need to really repent of their sins, you know. And, you know, he mistook the tone of my tweet and said, thanks, Megan. That's handy. What with Yom Kippur coming up? and so then I made sure I was new to Twitter, right? So my next post, I made sure I wouldn't be misunderstood. I said, Jewish customs are dead rote rituals that will take them all to hell. And, you know, his response was really swift, cutting, and angry is how I would describe it. But almost immediately, his tone changed. He realized that I was sincere, that I really believed that what I was doing was the right thing. And so he started making these arguments. He started asking questions, trying to understand where I was coming from. And this was happening with David. It was also happening with quite a few other people. David's specific role that early on was that he found, after about a year of conversation, he found the first internal inconsistency in our ideology. And there was no answer from the Bible to explain it.
What was it? Do you remember?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll never forget it. he was asking about one of our protest signs that was calling for the death penalty for gays. And, you know, he said, first he quoted the New Testament where Jesus says, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. It's like, didn't Jesus say? And I said, yes, we're not casting stones. We're preaching words. That's how we always answer that. And he said, yeah, but you're advocating that the government cast stones, which was like kind of sent me back for a second. And then he said, and also, what, didn't your mother have your oldest brother out of wedlock? And I said, yes. And she repented of that sin. And so she doesn't deserve that punishment. He goes, yeah, but if she had been executed, she wouldn't have had the opportunity to repent and be forgiven. So why are you advocating the death penalty for these people? Why are you trying to take away this opportunity to repent? And so those two arguments, those two things, like, addressed, you know, we had these responses, these canned responses. I mean, and we really believe that they seem to be, you know, correct answers. And then he showed the inconsistency there.
What was the tipping point that made you feel and believe that you had to leave?
The first contradiction that David found, that was extremely destabilizing for me, right? It was, like I said, it was the first time that I had come to realize that we could be wrong. And then also within the church, this group of men decided that they were the ones who should be ruling the church, that they should be the ones in these leadership positions. And so they just literally, it was like overnight, they just took over. It was without, there was no vote, there was no, and the way that Westboro has always operated was that everything had to be done, you know, with unanimity. Like, so if anybody disagreed, if anybody thought that we shouldn't take this action, we wouldn't. So the fact that this group of men just took over, and then they started doing things that I believed were unscriptural. So, for instance, photoshopping themselves into pickets that they had not actually attended. So it was all to get attention for the message, right? Because remember, for them, that's the only goal, is to publish this message that is the truth of God.
For you to contemplate leaving, I mean, that must have been devastating. I don't know any other way to describe it. I mean, how did you finally decide that you had to leave?
So I come to this understanding that I had this list of things that I believed were wrong and unbiblical, unscriptural. And, you know, eventually when I realized it wasn't just these few things, I came to believe we were just people. Like, I had always seen us as this divine institution that God himself was leading. Jesus Christ himself was leading Westboro Baptist Church. And when I came to believe that wasn't the case anymore, you know, there was a very brief moment where I thought, could I pretend to go along with this just so I could keep my family? And almost immediately, no. There's no chance that I'm going to keep doing these things that I understand are wrong, that are devastating to other people. And this was one of the things that after I left, David was instrumental after I left to helping me realize that there were things I could do to repair, to make amends. He taught me about this concept in Judaism called tikkun olam, which means to repair the world. He said, you and your family have added to the brokenness in the world, and you have a duty, as much as you can, to find a way to repair some of it. And that was this really hopeful moment that, you know, I don't have to. In fact, running away and hiding doesn't change anything. It doesn't do anything to convince my family to change their ways, and it doesn't help any of the people that I spent all those years hurting.
Do you have any relationship with your family now?
My family, they cannot have anything to do with us. They believe that, you know, their duty is to deliver me to Satan for the destruction of the flesh.
So are they praying for your death the way that they prayed for other people's deaths?
I think maybe, I don't know about my parents initially. I will say, so this is something, this praying for people to die thing, that's something that I came to believe was unscriptural. And for years, I made these arguments to my family in writing and, you know, privately in letters that didn't get responses, and in interviews. And for a while, they just doubled down. Eventually, they came to stop doing it. So there are several instances like that of things that I came to believe were unscriptural, and from the outside have been reaching out to them, you know, trying to find ways of helping them moderate, to change their minds on these issues so that they don't do as much damage to other people.
How can you reach out to them, though, when they won't talk to you?
It's a very one-sided. It's basically me writing. But the thing about, one of the wonderful things about Twitter is that it gives me a window into what they're thinking, what they're preaching, how things are changing. And so that's my window. That's how I know how things are, you know, what's happening there and where I can. I'm basically doing what David did for me, except they're not answering.
Do you still love them?
I do. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm sure they are frustrated with how I show that love now, and that I am out here basically trying to dismantle this thing that they have come to build. But you know, I do. I love them. I care about them. I understand that they're well-intentioned, that they're trying to do what they believe is right. And for me, that's a hopeful thing, right? Because that is something that I can, if we can find a way of reframing it, helping them see outside of this doggedly, persistently closed system that they were raised in, again, that there's hope for change.
Do you still have faith? And if so, in what?
I'm not religious anymore, but I absolutely am a believer in humanity, in the power of human connection, in the idea of grace. You know, people had grace for me when I seemed not to deserve it the most. And the fact that they were able to suspend their judgments long enough to have those conversations with me completely changed my life. And it turned me, so now instead of me being out there with Westboro creating new victims, I'm now, again, working for healing and change and try to repair some of that damage. That is huge. And it all came from that little bit, that willingness to suspend judgment, to become curious, to realize that I had been raised in this, that it was, you know, that grace, I really believe in it. So I will say I'm not religious anymore, but I absolutely still feel like a believer in so many ways.
Megan Phelps Roper, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And that's a positive note to end on. That's it for now. Remember, you can listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.